Good morning.
Good to see you all. A whole new experience for me, dealing with photographic shoots and various other areas. Always like to start punctually though. My name's Alex Levchuk. In case you're wondering, how do we pronounce this strange sounding name that's actually appeared for this week and next week in terms of the lecture process? Bit of background. Within the university, I'm program leader for public relations. I was the founder of SciFM. I teach science fiction for the English people, the English module, level 3, and also film and television studies, plus a variety of other aspects as well. And John actually asked me to come in to actually deliver both this session and next week's session, because what I do with the level 1, level 2 journalists actually echoes the sort of mass observation concept that I'm going to be speaking about today, and certainly ties in with the picture post in terms of its connections and various other factors. So we're really going to be looking at it from the historical perspective, setting the scene in terms of what the whole project was about, how it connects with perhaps contemporary aspects and things that we actually are doing, and hopefully give you a few sort of general suggestions and lines which will obviously provide you with a good grounding should you actually choose to do these topics in your essays as well. Okay, so that's the sort of overall line that I want to start off with. So you may well think, what on earth has he actually put a line from Daniel Defoe, who obviously did Robinson Crusoe amongst others there, published in 1724 and reprinted in 1725, 1727, etc. A tour through the whole island of Great Britain, divided into circuits or journeys containing a description of the principal cities and towns, their situation, government, and commerce. Well, one of the things about human beings is we love to collect information. We love to collect data. Arguably, the first mass observation project and collection of data might well have been the Domesday Book, when the Normans were effectively gathering data shortly after 1066 to find out what things were happening and so on. But ultimately, you've got this whole notion of the collection and the gathering of data, which, when we reach the 1930s, a number of key people actually thought, this is quite interesting. Put your hands up if you're from south of Watford. Ah, excellent, right? Because the accepted line that one of the key folk we're going to be hearing about today, Tom Harrison, took in the 1920s, 1930s, was that people in the north were a race apart. Totally different. You know, it's like a strange world. Whole, very peculiar. I, of course, have maintained that, of course, we have to go down south to civilise the folks south of Watford. Sorry, anyway. In terms of that whole connection, we do have this issue in terms of who are we? Who are we as a people? Who are we as a culture? And so on. Writers such as J.B. Priestley have kind of wrestled with this whole notion. What do we mean when we talk about the English people? What do we mean when we talk about the British people? What are key elements that kind of represent us and sort of see us developed and so on? And it was generally seen that as photography was established by this particular era, as you'd see this, Priestley's English Journey, a Jubilee edition with 80 period photographs. Priestley, of course, being primarily a playwright. I mean, he produced Time and the Hendersons. I Have Been Here Before, a lot of other plays that kind of gone down as dealing with time and approaching time from that perspective. But Britain, you've got to bear in mind, in the 1930s was going through a series of upheavals. We still had an empire, we, collectively, British Empire was still there, but we'd had the Great War, we'd had a massive sort of upheaval in terms of social aspects there, and we were certainly in a heavily industrialised part of our existence. Okay? Just another little hands-up exercise here. Can you pop your hand up if you can remember the 2012 London Olympics? Great, fantastic, short-term memory is there. If you also can cast your mind back to that opening ceremony that Danny Boyle directed, and can you remember when Kenneth Branagh was taking on board the role of being Isenberg, Kingdom Brunel, and we kind of went from a very rural culture to a mass mechanised age and a whole range of other factors that was there? If not, look it up at YouTube, because it's still there and you can still access that. But that is really the kind of change that we've gone through over, you know, the period 1800 to 1900, a century of change in so many ways. And as is often the case with these century sort of scenarios, we're looking to sort of find out what is it precisely that kind of impacts on people as a result of this. Yes, we have a class system. Engels wrote in his History of the Working Class that there was a difference between the working class... I'm sorry, are you actually having a conversation at the back there? Because I would like to actually get these points across. If you want to have a chat, could you go outside, please? Okay? Thank you. Sorry. In terms of the sort of key things that Engels was talking about, again, it's the situation of the class and so on. Brandt, as you can see there, noting the English at home. And it's something that, again, a lot of people are getting sorted out in terms of how do we represent this? How are these things being represented? What's happening in the 1930s? A really good technique to use whenever you're actually sort of doing any study of photography or images or packages is find out from timelines exactly what's happening in the culture at that time. So in the 1930s, you've got the rise of fascism, mass unemployment, the depression. You've also got an abdication of the reigning monarch at the time, Edward VI. Whole range of sort of issues and cultural aspects. But did this really impact on people? It certainly impacted on certain people, but how did it actually impact on the classes and the cultures and the folk that we actually see there? In other words, the working class. If you watch Downton Abbey, you get another little flavour of the sort of areas and issues that the upstairs, downstairs system provides. And it was generally seen that one of the key things that could be explored here was to use the relatively new sciences of anthropology to study these areas. Tom Harrison, who's again a name, as I say, you'll hear quite a lot about in terms of mass observation, he had effectively had a range of activities, but one of the things he most enjoyed was studying foreign peoples, people from a foreign land. He also liked ornithology, effectively, but he was clearly an observer. There were also folk who worked within the mass observation project, such as Humphrey Jennings, who went on to become a fairly key documentary filmmaker, and to a lesser extent John Grierson and Charles Madge. They all were kind of interested in terms of finding out, you know, what is this situation? How can we apply this whole system? And what's the best thing? Do you actually ask people, how do you feel about having to slush out the manure day in, day out, etc.? How do you sort of cope about that? Or do you simply observe them? Do you actually literally embed yourself within the culture and just as if you were watching birds in a sort of ornithological setting or if you were watching an indigenous people, you would not interfere. You would note, you would find out what was actually happening, you would actually take records about what was taking place depending on the cultural ethos at the time, whether you're actually dealing with coal miners or whether you're dealing with people in a social environment, but you would actually make a record of what was happening. One of the great things about this and the fact that you can go to the library and go online, and we'll be doing that in the seminar sessions, is actually looking at the vast range of photographs and images that we actually had from this period and more. So once more, we're in the situation of finding out, why do these people exist? How do they exist? Is this important? Is it important to get a record of that whole side of things? And can you actually sort of learn by embedding yourself within them, actually living in their particular surroundings? And the town that was actually taken to really focus on by the Mass Observation Project in Britain was Bolton. Anybody from Bolton here? Oh, it's okay, because Bolton was actually also referred to as work town. So Bolton, Lancashire, heartland of the whole sort of system, that was the place that the Mass Observer movement decided that's where we're going to be based, that's where we're going to work through that whole process. So, what are we getting here? We're getting a kind of combination of three zones. Photography, obviously, because that's a good way of documenting things as they happen, the reality of the image, snapshots of reality, and working through that basis as well. Writing in terms of recording and noting things such as, how do people drink their beer? How do people actually have sexual relations? That's also a serious sort of aspect of the whole thing. How do they actually sort of work? You know, every literal aspect, all the minutiae of life, almost from waking up in the morning to going back to bed at night with all the drudgeries in between would be recorded, and that was the idea of where we were working through that whole process. I mentioned Priestley and briefly Bill Brandt. Harrison was very much the leading light of the mass observation movement, but also gentlemen you may have heard of, Eric Blair, or to use his pen name, his writing name, George Orwell. He was also keen to find out issues relating to this. In fact, he went off to the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics pre-war and was so shocked by what he actually saw there, they came back and wrote 1984, and it was as another sort of warning from that perspective. But these are the kind of key players around about 85 years ago, 85 or so years ago, 80 or so years ago, who are really beginning to put together this whole essence of what we call mass observation and so on. And I'll be talking next week about how the picture posts also really impacts in terms of this. It's a celebration of the ordinary. If there's one phrase I want you to take away from this whole system, it is that notion of a celebration of the ordinary. It's not looking at Hollywood, it's not looking at glamour, it's not looking actually putting together the sort of images that were in the magic picture palaces of the time and seeing the stars of the day actually being portrayed, you know, whether it be Boris Karloff, Laurel and Hardy, Errol Flynn, Judy Garland and so on. It's just ordinary, everyday people like us. And it's celebration of their ordinary lives, which you may think, how dull, how boring. But it does tap into this anthropological notion of trying to understand what it's all about. And again, that's part of the human condition, it's part of the culture. Now, I'm sure somebody's delivering this session, maybe as a virtual hologram, in 80 years from now, people will say, they're coping with Brexit, they're coping with terrorism, they're coping with Al-Qaeda, they're coping with presidential disasters in the States. How did they get on? How do we actually record? What are the sort of views that we actually get from that point of view? What images reflect and reinforce that sort of cultural aspect? And that's partly why anthropological expeditions developed, to start unpicking this. The social sciences really took off in the 1920s, 1930s. Prior to that, if you were doing the sciences, it was either natural sciences, i.e. Botany, or biological sort of based ones, zoology and so on, or it would be the physical sciences, chemistry and physics. These social sciences of psychology, of sociology, of actually sort of beginning to appreciate what public relations is and so on, really emerged in the 1920s and 30s, initially in America, because it was a case of how do we actually cope with things like the Great Depression? And kind of getting to the stage of if you can figure out what's going on in these areas, that gives you an insight into how you can actually prevent disasters like the Great Depression or the recession actually happening again, or you can at least sort of cope and sort of nudge people into the right direction and so on. Because there's also health issues as well with respect to this. As I said, consider some of the things that actually happened following what was referred to 80 years ago as the Great War, because there wasn't a Second World War then. Huge amount of debt. Debt like you would not believe across the whole base. Again, if you're into your literature and your writings and you want to get a snapshot, certainly in terms of America, check out the work of F. Scott Fitzgerald and indeed the equal stunning work of the Great Gatsby and his line there and the juxtaposition of the whole sort of system, and also John Steinbeck, Grapes of Wrath and the Mice and Men. Mice and Men are really small, easily read, a couple of nights to actually do it online, Kindle devices and so on, but it really gives a snapshot into the kind of real hardships that we're going through for people who literally had to go out and seek work and tramp all over the place and so on. And certainly within Britain, it wasn't much easier. You know, we owed America quite a lot in terms of obviously bailing us out in the First World War, and as I said, there was a rise of fascism. Certain chap who believed in his painting and was very depressed because nobody actually liked his painting, so he decided to actually take on the National Fascism movement. Adolf Hitler was obviously growing, and the whole rise of the National Socialist movement, both in Germany, in Italy with Benito Mussolini, and arguably in Spain with General Franco, because the Spanish Civil War is also taking place at this time. So you've got, you know, not just civil war in Europe, you've got sort of rise of fairly unsavory activities as well. and you've got a British sort of working in an area where, you know, we're doomed, you know, governments are falling and a whole range of things. There is a case of economic depression. You know, it's the first time people really appreciate this. I mean, these days, as millennials, you're kind of used to the rhetoric saying it's times of austerity, we're all in this together, and so on. This was kind of first time. I mean, prior to the 1920s and 30s, and obviously prior to the Great War, it was pretty much a century or so of uninterrupted growth. Not necessarily pleasant for all, but there was a general sort of progress from that. Here's a case where the wheels have literally come off. So how do we connect within that? And there was, indeed, this global slump. I'm not doing a financial lecture, but I mean, just the sort of the headline figures that are actually there. In the United Kingdom, there was a quarter drop in output, 25% down. And of course, the Wall Street crash in 1929, where people are hurling themselves off the building that was to become the Empire State Building, committing suicide, you know, all of these kind of... I mean, probably the closest one we've actually had recently was the bursting of the bubble in terms of e-commerce, etc. And the banking crisis, again, that's sort of another sort of thing. But again, possibly mild by comparison to what you're getting there. So lots of great ingredients, which is great for photographers and folks to actually really document what is actually happening here. As we said, this was by far the worst economic slump of the 20th century. Mass unemployment. This line of people in the north being a race apart, fine. But what do you do when your predominant industrial workers are based in the north of England, Manchester, Bolton, Liverpool, Newcastle, and so on, Hull, and actually, you know, literally, there isn't any sort of work around for them to actually do. You know, there is mass unemployment that's actually there, leading to this sort of sense of general political unrest, social desperation, something you may have heard of because it's still often commended, the Jarrow March. I'll show you a few photographs of the Jarrow March in a few moments. The Jarrow March actually started off as an attempt by a group of folk from Jarrow in Gateshead or Newcastle and so on to actually march to London, more or less to demonstrate just how poor the conditions were. It was a protest. It's a line from that point of view. The general strike had also taken place in 1927. So again, that sort of was a precursor in the 20s to what we were seeing in the 1930s. So there were lots of political areas which you think, good grief, thanks, things are bad. They can only get worse. There's the Jarrow March. Again, we're seeing the sort of, I mean, you could always say, what a classic group of Northerners. They've even got the genuine flat caps and cigarettes. Fantastic. But, you know, again, you're getting that sort of sense of where we're actually seeing these folk developing, what they're doing. And again, the whole notion was it was literally a march down the country from the north to the south, you know, stopping off on various routes and points such as Cambridge and so on within that field. So into all of that, I mean, there's a sort of line, not obviously a photograph, but the actual sort of notion of, again, the split between the upper and lower working classes, the observation of what's happening in terms of suddenly the Jarrow Crusade is viewed by the landed gentry, or the people who are perfectly okay because they're still actually enjoying the good life. But unfortunately, again, class consciousness, that was not necessarily part and parcel of the whole sequence. So, into all of this, and into all this sort of line in terms of some people saying, well, actually, maybe we should have a revolution, because they had that in Russia in 1918, 1919. They've got, you know, under Lenin and then latterly Stalin, a station for the workers, a nation for the workers. They're aware of that. It's interesting, again, if you can compare what's happening with the mass automation. I mean, that's the other thing in terms of what is also one of the other reasons for this mass unemployment. Well, Henry Ford, huge automation in terms of the car manufacturing industry and automation of a number of other sort of factors taking place as well. It's no surprise that actually this is the first time in 1923 that the term robot is coined by the Czech writer Karel Čapek, actually his brother Josef Čapek, and in their short play, which again you can read or actually listen to, called Rossum's Universal Robots. This sense that actually humanity was losing out to the machine. And actually, similar sort of package today, where you sort of think, well, where do we sit with respect to all of the information technology and all of the robots that sort of work within that whole system? However, one of the offshoots of technology is it enables people to get better quality cameras, easy sort of filmmaking material, you can actually work through the whole process, and you can actually use those a lot more easily than what used to be the case if you have to lug a whole range of magnesium flares and images and photographic sort of packages and plates around for you. In other words, you're seeing the gradual evolution of documentary. Now, some of those documentaries, as done by Herbert Jennings and John Grierson and so on, focused on things like the Scottish fishing industry, like coal miners' experiences. Some of them, again, were not exactly... They were played as being a real snapshot of reality and actually captured as such, but they were also fakes. They were set up. And you do photography, you know that actually the image is all powerful, but what you see within the image can be created. You know, this is pre-Photoshop, obviously, but in terms of a range of other factors, you've got adjustments that are being made. One of the classic examples being one shot that Grierson took to demonstrate the Scottish fishing industry. And actually, it was faked. It was faked because it was taken in an aquarium in Plymouth. And it was a shot of fish behind the sort of screen. Now, you know, again, it's arguable. I mean, one of the debates that I sometimes have with journalism students is if the ends justify the means, if you've actually chosen the right things to work through on that basis, doesn't really matter if you fake it, does it? Or is there an ethical issue? Also, as I mentioned, obviously, with what has happened in Russia, Karl Marx had written Das Kapital, obviously, at the start of the century before then, there was this sense of a need for social justice. You know, the Labour Party is really beginning to come to fruition here in this particular area. But you are getting that whole notion between the radicals and the intellectuals in London and in the sort of universities, etc. Predominantly male, it has to be said, predominantly male. Women not really sort of well represented in higher education at that stage. After all, women had just got the vote in the 1920s, so it's quite a way before you get a level of equality. But you do get this sense of saying, well, something must be done. How do we address these key sort of factors? And then how do we address them if we actually don't record them and don't actually take them on to another level from that perspective? A little bit of background there about Priestley. That is a fairly standard profile, actually, of the kind of mass observation people. Not necessarily that it all came from Bradford, but they might have been based in the north, reasonably intelligent, went off to university, Oxford, Cambridge, etc., had experience of fighting in the First World War, but more importantly, the last line that's actually there, understood the power of emerging media. Priestley was one of the go-to folks that the BBC used to use to actually talk about stuff, kind of expert who would actually sort of have a regular weekly talk in which he could kind of, you know, discuss things ranging from the State of the Nation onwards. You can actually listen to some of Priestley's work online, up to Dunkirk, actually, in the Second World War, where he talks about how the little boats were sort of rescuing all the sort of British troops and getting them back to Britain and so on and so forth. But again, part of that establishment mainstream media-based setup. There he is. And again, not too surprisingly, you've got a very traditional sort of portrait image there, the contemplative artist. A thinker. Yeah. Contrast that with the image of the Jarrow Crusade. Slightly different in terms of the era, and also the backdrop in which they're working through. You know, you've got that notion of how honestly can somebody like Priestley really understand what we're going through unless you've lived it? The old sort of North American, Native American proverb, don't actually sort of judge a person unless you've walked a mile in their moccasins or shoes. By which stage, if you walked a mile in their shoes, then you'll be far enough away from them to run away even for them. Never mind. Okay. Other sort of areas in terms of why people actually sort of work on this basis. Well, you are getting a collection of arty types. Artists, writers, photographers, all of whom are effectively developing this whole process. Bill Brandt, as we mentioned, fairly well-known photographer. But you're ultimately getting this whole notion of almost a perfect storm. You've got lots of stuff out there that's happening, and you've got a way of actually recording that material and actually sort of not just serving it for posterity so that people can talk about you in 80 years from time from now and so on, but actually really embedding it into your culture and so on. There's one of his sort of lines from that particular area. And again, the general line that we are asked to buy into for this as the audience is these are not posed for shots. They are effectively you know, showing some of the conditions, the housewife's knee, scrubbing the steps, all the sort of aspects that people are sort of working through and relating to. And again, we'll talk about this in seminars in terms of how effective it actually is. And does it really matter whether or not, we don't really know whether that was a shot that was posed or not. I mean, some documentary filmmakers actually wanted to have people talking about themselves. Because one of the accepted lines in the media in particular was there was always another voice that would come over, usually a received pronunciation voice. But was it much more effective to have a newsreel or an area where people would talk about their own challenges and problems? That authentic voice. Authentic is a word we hear a great deal about these days in terms of how authentic is it? How truthful? How close to the essence of reality is it? Yeah, and clearly you're getting these... I mean, this is one of the areas where I think a lot of photographers, even now, still prefer to work in black and white, because you get a real starkness, you know, in the shades of grey, the monochrome element of the texture that comes across. And it looks great. It looks so British, so grey and dull. It's not colourful. It's, you know, again, if we moved on to consider sort of the latter part of the 20th century, we'll see obviously significant changes in terms of approaches and so on. Maybe we're going back to that sort of dull, grey, unenlightened sort of package with rain-swept roofs. Could almost be Lincoln. It isn't, but you know, it could be in terms of the sort of way the images that's sort of coming through with that, the back-to-back houses, the social living conditions, the challenges that we're faced with that. Why is it important to record this? Why is it, again, in terms of mass observation, that people are sitting in with work and so on? Well, again, to either improve those conditions, because one of the other areas that's frequently used is let's make things better. You know, let's not sort of just say, oh, it's like that all the time. We don't have to sort of go anywhere at all. We can improve it. We can develop it. We can get rid of these kind of things and improve them lot of all. And so on. I mean, again, obviously law and order from that perspective there in terms of you know, the 1930s and life. And again, the other great thing that we've got here in terms of the material is you can look at all of the cinematic images that are being made. Yeah, because by this stage, cinema has pretty much found its feet. It's got sound. It's got colour in the sort of other part of the 30s, but basically it's been around as an art form for about 20 years. You know, the first sort of motion picture, first major motion picture was out in 1916. And obviously people have been working through that. So in terms of technology, seeing the moving image as well as the still image, you've got those two things that are very much locking into place from that perspective. But how do we then sort of tie this into to Harrison's work? And again, an excellent sort of text, which is, if you're interested in following this through, is David Hall's Work Town. And this sort of line, which I read from the back, which is, in the late 1930s, the Lancashire town of Bolton witnessed a groundbreaking social experiment. Inspired by the leadership of the charismatic anthropologist Tom Harrison, dozens of idealistic young men and women headed north to go people-watching in the first project of its kind. Their aim was to study the everyday lives of ordinary working people in the pub, in the dance hall, in the factory, at work, and at play. Well, again, cynically, you might say, well, what else was Tom Harrison going to do? Basically, he'd had an affair with a woman who was married, who wasn't going to marry him. There were all sorts of other personal issues in his background. He was looking for something to actually do. He had enjoyed his time, which he spent overseas. There is sort of native cultures in the Seychelles and other sort of global reaches. He thought, why not, you know, let's get into this anthropological thing. You know, let's actually start developing a study and work through that process. You know, let's find out how people do live and make sure that we're recording that and getting a detailed sort of view of the key things that are actually there. So these sort of messages that we see constantly can not only be recorded for history, but maybe we can actually sort of say, is this the best thing for this chap to actually do after he's just got home from inhaling all that coal dust to obviously light up his nicotine-based cigarette as well? Actually, to be fair, if you ever do a study, you will find at this stage cigarettes were very much deemed as being health-orientated. If you wanted to calm your nerves, you'd have a cigarette. You know, it was, your doctors would prescribe cigarettes to vote. Kind of pretty, I mean, this cigarette could save your life was actually a cultural an advertising strapline. In many cases, something which again maintained its presence pretty much until the latter part of the 20th century. Any smokers in here? No, it's all right, you don't have to ask. You see, that makes your time in halls of residence look all the more sweeter, doesn't it, effectively, in terms of the after sort of work bath, etc. And that's probably going to be a once-a-week occurrence, okay? Probably Saturday night, probably just ahead of Sunday, obviously, for that sort of point of view. So again, the sort of lines that are actually there. Now, you might well say, well, this is all very good, but has anybody really asked these people about what they feel about being photographed and so on? Because again, you've got a cultural issue there in terms of bias and elements relating to what we're seeing, how we're seeing it, and so on. But as I say, it goes back to that other key word of the documentarians, a celebration of the ordinary. We're not looking at the extraordinary here, unless we find it in that ordinary. We're seeing those day-to-day lives, what sort of images are maintained within that, and how things are actually developed within that whole sort of system. I'll just pop that in there because, again, it's an interesting aspect of Dicherico's sort of almost surreal attempt. I mean, he's drawing on the sort of work of Dali and Picasso and the surrealist movement as well, which is another sort of aspect which certainly in terms of intellectual circles was impacting itself as well from that point of view. Is that more or less effective than the photographic image? Again, discuss, topic for debate and so on. Likewise with respect to that. Okay. Let's focus a bit more on, again, the topic of what I wanted to speak about today. I said about the science of sociology. Well, actually, yes, that also relates to the scientific method. As opposed to literally just randomly taking images of things that happen to catch the photographer's overall view or interest, you would specifically try to target and note down and record detailed aspects of what it was you were observing. It's interesting, looking at some of the responses that came from the people at Bolton, some people thought these guys were spies. You know, they'd actually sort of there to little noting things down. You could actually see them with their notebooks and pads, obviously noting issues down, writing up about saying, this, that, and so on. And there was a kind of, I suppose, feeling that, well, they're here, they're observing us, we don't have to, fine, take it as read. You know, there was no sort of notion of infringing on privacy or various other factors. Because again, we're seeing very much here the sort of cultural-based thing. These people must know what they're doing, because obviously they've been to university, they've gone through various other factors, they've really studied this, you know, it's really focused, it must be good, it's great academic work from that perspective. But what it has provided us in terms of, as I say, 8 decades down the line, is a wealth of information and a wealth of images, some of which do reinforce the stereotypes of the North and the South and so on. I mean, you still get that rhetoric being used by politicians today about the difference between the North and the South and the, you know, the Northern workhouse, the Northern powerhouse that's sort of often sort of mentioned. So there's still that sort of North-South divide that's actually present. But again, those have sort of emerged from the roots of what Mass observation sort of went to develop. I don't want to spend too much in terms of this because I'll be talking about that next week. So I'll skip through that. Let's talk a little bit about this because, as the essay suggests, here's what I'll put this, the Farm Security Administration, FSA, and mass observation projects carried out in America and Britain in the 1930s to 1940s had tangibly different outcomes but a similar set of core values. Okay, so what was the FSA actually looking to do? Well, as I said, they were approaching this observation of the general ordinariness from the perspective of, again, the farm situation after the Great Depression, after the Dust Bowl. I mean, one of the things which had occurred in America, which led to Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck, and so on, writing about it, was not only did you have a financial crisis, but you also, through because of over-farming, had huge swathes of middle America that effectively became dust bowls. So they couldn't even grow much wheat to sustain. So you had, not famine conditions exactly, but certainly farming became much more difficult to actually do. And you think of the size of America, problems were actually there from that perspective. Mass media is recording both, because obviously the radio is there, as well as the press, the printing press, and all sorts of other factors. And you're seeing changing social situations as well. Plus a huge fear in America that they didn't want to go the same way as the communists over in Russia and the Soviet Union has become because it was a different sort of area entirely. I mean, we saw that manifested in the aftermath of the Second World War with the Cold War and so on. But nevertheless, the same sort of social science approaches were being used by both. So you would still, in essence, embed your reporters, embed your recorders within the areas that they're observing, with a view to obviously get a development of what things were happening and so on. Outcomes, well, again, both used in different sort of aspects, but you've still got the sort of sense that the images we see of that zone, the images, you've seen a couple of them on the session so far, they do have a deep impact. They're things we don't really want to return to. You know, as I say, people talk about the Great Depression and even the words, you know, time of economic upheaval, savage sort of works, etc. They're not areas that feel particularly sort of well-liked, etc. So on our collective culture, you know, they've certainly had an impact. They've had a resonance. They've connected on that sort of basis. And again, it's that whole notion of culture viewed through the lens of the academic, which is particularly interesting about the sort of mass observation scenarios. Some of the key factors that are actually there, of course, that's number one of them. Yeah. This remains, and I suppose that's why they call it mass observation, the largest investigation that we've actually had into what would be referred to as popular culture in the 20th century. Are we having a similar thing in the 21st century? Probably, except nobody's really kind of itemised the sort of details and so on. And obviously there's so much media now, social media of course as well. I mean, a lot of academics have also turned around and said we should be beginning to archive and develop the sort of look at Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and even back in the day, Bebo, MySpace and various other sort of aspects. So sort of get a relationship in terms of how people are actually communicating, what things are being said. Are we sort of communicating via emoticons, smileys, and so on? What is the sort of popular culture that sort of really sort of impacts on where we are, the sort of 21st century period? That's again sort of one that you can also access, and we'll be doing this in terms of seminar. But it's worth actually looking at, purely and simply from the sort of cover that I've actually put there, because yes, you're talking about the whole wonderful spiral inwards, spiral outwards, even a labyrinth kind of area. What do human beings do? We eat, we queue, we kiss, we travel, we wish, we sleep, we have sex, we cook, we holiday, we hear, we laugh, we engage in art, what do we fear, what do we court, we relax, we drink, we have politics. You know, all of those kind of areas. Yeah, maybe it's just one of those sort of curiosity aspects of saying, well, how do we record that sort of things? I mean, one of the areas that, again, is often discussed is we're so influenced, or can be influenced, and people talk about the influence of the media and the influence of the mass media, what we see represented, kind of informs how we dress, kind of informs how we behave, kind of reinforces social norms and social values. Is that good? Well, it's nice we're not all anarchic today, and it's nice that we're sort of not going completely crazy on the whole system, but maybe you need a bit of anarchy every so often. You need a bit of sort of change to actually work through that process. Again, it's an interesting thing. I mean, wasn't Tom Harrison and the mass observation, but wasn't that quite an interesting thing where suddenly going to observe folk? I'll just give you another short excerpt from the sort of section which I was particularly interested in terms of anthropology at home, in which Harrison quotes, "Nearly everybody who is not born into the working class regards them as almost a race apart." That was the quote I was quoting about in terms of Tom Harrison. And number six, Groats Village, Groats Buildings, was a tall Georgian townhouse just yards away from Blackheath Village, one of London's more affluent suburbs. Fronting directly onto the wide open spaces of the Common, the home of the poet and journalist Charles Madge, his partner and fellow poet Kathleen Rain, and their two young children was a world away from the smoke and grime of industrial Bolton. But within this elegant house, Madge was thinking along very similar lines to Harrison about the abdication crisis and the state of British society. And with a group of like-minded friends, he was beginning to have discussions looking at what they might be able to do about it. Now, I said the abdication crisis, you might think, oh, the King of England, well, I say if the Queen's decided to abdicate, it's just stepped down. And why is he stepping down? He's going to marry a divorced woman who's also an American. When they were actually asked, nobody cared in Bolton. I couldn't find anybody who actually cared one iota about that. Which was something which had been so managed within the media, to the extent that it was, you know, the BBC and newspapers could not even go public until Edward effectively made his resignation speech live on air, his abdication speech live on air. And even after that, they really weren't bothered. And yet, culturally, we tend to think, or certainly the view was, of Charles Madge, other associates of Tom Harrison, this is a huge sort of issue. So again, that's another sort of element in terms of sometimes... Now, you could say, what have we got in terms of legacy? Well, opinion pollsters. People take sort of polls about, you know, everything from, are you sort of, you know, what would you do in the event of a mass power cut, right the way through to your particular habits when it comes to, I don't know, learning in the 21st century. And what sort of things do you actually look for? Surveys, you know, National Student Survey and so on. Constant data collection. The kind of metrics of management and how you work through that. And that is also something which is worth considering, because sometimes squaring that circle between the artist, the photographer, and actually having to quantify everything can be quite a challenge. You know, does it really impact for the better, or is it something completely different? So I put this out at the end because it's the University of Sussex that actually holds the online archive. Of all the sort of material relating to mass observation, which again we'll have a look at in seminars over in the library, etc. From that point of view, there was an original intention of producing a number of sort of texts in terms of this particular project, but I've kind of put that Penguin book up there, or that cover of the Penguin special there, because it kind of explains primarily what this was all about. You know, what Charles Madge and Tom Harrison really kind of kicked off in 1937. I mean, arguably, 2 years later, we were at war with Germany again. The Second World War was in action. What we were actually doing then, it's a whole range of things that people really care from that particular perspective. But the key thing, the phrase that kind of really echoes out from this basis is, it's not the science of birds, it's not the science of rocks, it's not the science of land or chemicals, it's the science of ourselves. It's adapting that whole notion to who we are, what is our cultural identity, how that connects in terms of the whole essence of mass, as in bulk, observation. Hopefully, I intend to actually publish this lecture online as a podcast, but I'll be putting up the slides as well. John actually asked me to put up the slides, but I couldn't because I wasn't actually enrolled as an instructor on the site as yet. So that will happen in terms of all the slides you've seen will go online probably within the next 168 hours or week or so. Has anybody got any initial questions at present? All clear? In which case, I'll see all of you over the next 2 hours, but the first group of people, obviously, we march over to the library for the first session there, which is UL 101. Make sure you've signed the register for this lecture as well, please.